we begin, like we do each Tuesday, by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How's it going there, brother man?
Very well, thank you. How are you in this steamy afternoon?
I just got in from a run, actually. Timed it well to be ready for your call.
How far did you go today?
I went 3 miles, and then I was scolded when I came out of the Starbucks with the water by a woman who said, "You ran in this heat? What are you, an idiot?" Like, okay, offensive. Why don't you go somewhere and have a beer? Like, whoa, transitioning to the cerveza awfully quickly.
Did you do the monument, or did they close it up because of the heat?
They take away my freedom of choice with the monument. They don't leave it up to me. When it reaches a certain something on whatever this very important heat index is, they shut it down. But what happened the other day on Sunday was I was trying to do it 10 times. It's really difficult in the second half of July and August, and I was in there. I was the only one in there for a long time. And I heard this, like, creaking of the metal door downstairs. I said, wait, still in here. I almost got locked in, and I was going to have to go back to the top and try to get on the camera and wave for a rescue.
Oh dear. Well, we would know. Like, if you had made it till Tuesday and you didn't show up here on the program, I would alert the authorities, and I would say, first place you need to check is the monument.
I'll be honest. I had already, mentally at least, I didn't put this into practice, but I had picked out a bathroom spot.
It's good to be prepared. That's, you know, you're at the top of your game. There's no question. Well, we have a lot of ground to cover today, a lot of things going on. And let's start with a guy who will celebrate an anniversary later this week. Herman Melville, born 200 years ago this Thursday.
Big bicentennial there for Mr. Melville. And yeah, I like the idea of what we're going to be talking about here. Really quintessentially American in a way, artist, but in an off-kilter, fun, piquantly interesting way. And Melville was certainly a wacky, wacky dude, as his friend Nathaniel Hawthorne could have told you. Hawthorne admired Melville greatly, but he was also a little weirded out by the guy, because Melville was not somebody who would self-bill as chill. He was one intense guy. And when he wrote something like Moby Dick, which he wrote really at a young age, I don't know if people realize how young he was when he wrote Moby Dick. This is like early 30s. He writes his buddy Hawthorne and he says, "Oh yeah, bit of a problem here. I have written an evil book." And he really believed that it had come from like the lower circles of hell. And I think what happens with Melville is we get this idea of a very sententious writer and a very serious writer and a very dry writer, despite the nautical themes for a lot of his work. And that's not true, because Melville, in addition to being an intense guy, was one funny bloke. And if you've read something like Bartleby, it anticipates perfectly our passive age, our "I would prefer not to age." And that refrain in that book becomes hilarious when someone's like, "Hey, can you go over there and just like get me a cup of water while you're not doing anything?"
I would prefer not to.
People are like, "What is up with this dude, with this refrain of his that he's so loyal to?" And each time that Melville repeats the line, it manages to become more funny. And he wrote popular books for a while before all of the critics decided that they completely detested him.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think sophomore year of high school, an English teacher introduced us to that. And for my pack of borderline idiots, that became our answer to everything for the better part of that year. "I would prefer not to."
It's a great line. And Melville's problem so far, as Melville saw it, was that the works that he thought were really good were the works that no one wanted anything to do with. And the works that he thought were complete trash, when he was writing to Hawthorne saying, "I'm whoring myself around. This is beneath me and degrading," things like Redburn. Redburn is this tale of the sea and a merchant seaman, but it's very rich. It's not like this letdown after some of the moralizing of Moby Dick. I mean, it's swashbuckling and all of that, and you get the whiff of the swash in your nostrils and everything, but the prose is impeccable, and the prose is very poetic, and that makes sense, because Melville for a long time viewed himself as just a poet. Before he wrote Billy Budd at the end of his life, which he didn't finish, he had gone 30 years. Think of that. I mean, people didn't live as long back then. He went 30 years without writing prose. He just wrote poetry. He wrote Clarell, this 18,000, I mean, that's a big-ass poem. That's the longest poem in the in American history. 18,000-line Clarell poem. It's like, boom. He was deeply, he was as invested in that as someone like James Joyce was invested in Finnegan's Wake.
And he's one of those guys that people always cite. I guess, you know, maybe the Michael Jordan comparison is a bit much when people say, oh, Michael got cut from his JV team, whatever. And people always say, well, Melville had very little success. People didn't appreciate him until he was gone.
He had a good run for a while. Some of that stuff, it's funny now as I face some of the things I face. When we talk about the hardships and the impecunity that some artists dealt with, it wasn't as much as history kind of rewrite. Mm. He was a popular writer for a while. Someone like Edgar Allan Poe, we sort of have that same narrative assumption. And Poe was a household name for quite a while, writing the Raven and all of that. And he was known throughout the land, not just in literary circles. And Melville was that way too. But Melville was not necessarily his own best ally. And even his aspect, his visual aspect, the guy looks like a human thunderstorm. And he wasn't a shrewd marketer necessarily. And you know what? He also did not give a bleep. He was saying that he wanted readers, but at the same time, Hawthorne's reaching out to him. Melville's like, no, I am going in this direction. But what you get with Melville, for all of the stylistic range, and this to me is the salient point with him, you know instantly with him within a clause with whom you are dealing. And that's how it goes, whether it's Dylan or whether it's Mozart or whether it's Melville. That's how you tell a true master. They switch up the styles, and they're variegated from A to B to C, but you always know instantly that they are the one behind it.
For years, the story went that the New York Times, in his obituary, called him Henry Melville by mistake, but apparently that's just urban legend, which is too bad because it's a great story.
It is. He's one of those people like FitzHenry Lane, the painter, who there was some confusion over what his name was or how Melville's last name was spelled, and he was not a guy who left his papers in great order for people to come along and help him out posthumously. He was just, he had these balls of paper with things cut and scratched out, and even his widow couldn't tell what the name of something like Billy Budd was. She's going through this, trying to do right by his legacy, and she didn't even know what the name of the book was. They had to get like a team of researchers in to eventually figure out what that was.
And you'll have a piece on Melville in the Washington Post later this week?
It'll be either this week, because I did one of those deals where I check in with the editor. I'm like, oh, hey, do you need anything from me? And you get the vacation away mail. So it either will be this week or it will be at the end of August, unless I am getting the shaft, which would be financially regretful for me. And I'm also now doing an essay on Bartleby. It's humor and its relevance in our passive-aggressive age. Next week for the American Interest.
Excellent. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Next up, I want to talk about someone that people may not know by name, but certainly know her work, and that's a woman who was a screenwriter and a producer and associate of Alfred Hitchcock, Joan Harrison.
Yes, Joan Harrison. She was one of the very first. In fact, I think there are only two others, female movie producers in Hollywood. She was English. And as you probably know, listeners, that our Mr. Hitchcock was in England before he came over to the States around late 30s for Rebecca, for David O. Selznick. And one day he put an advertisement out when he was in England for a secretary. And all of these people showed up. Actually, they were all women. That's not me being sexist. That's actually how it went. And Joan Harrison, fun girl, was in bed with a hangover. And her roomie's like, you know what? There's this great opportunity. She gets up, pops an aspirin, gets in the car, races, blags her way past most of the people in the line, and she is able to get an audience with Hitchcock and get this job. For a while, she is his secretary. Now, Hitchcock did not let many people into his inner artistic circle. In fact, you really let in at this kind of level for all of his collaborations with Bernard Herrmann, whatnot. His wife, Alma.
Right,
Alma
right.
is the great unbilled hero of mid-century cinema. She was, in many ways, his creative partner.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't get enough attention and enough credit for that. But then the other part of this triumvirate was Joan Harrison, who starts writing Hitchcock's films, becomes this trusted voice for him, works on Salvatore, films of that nature, has a hand to a degree in Rebecca. And then in 1944, 75 years ago, she strikes out on her own, and she creates a picture. She produces it. She doesn't direct it, called Phantom Lady, which is this bizarre straddling of the noir mystery and thriller in Hitchcockian world. There's nothing quite like this picture, and it was a sensation in time. One of those don't spoil the ending thing. Now, when we watch it these days, you pretty much know what the ending is at the midpoint, but that doesn't matter. It's very exciting. It uses a lot of silence, which you don't see, and there is this jazz scene in the film where there's no dialogue, and it's an after-hours session, and it's all moving camera and this jazz beat, and you wonder when you watch this how on earth they got this past the censors, because as you well know, tomorrow, Mr. Kimball, is National Orgasm Day, and this depiction in this portion of this film is like, she must have turned to somebody and said, you know what, let's have soft porn in this film and get it past the censors, and she did. And any film with Elijah Cook in it is almost guaranteed creepy little pervy dude in this film to be a good movie.
She also went on, I think, with Norman Lloyd to produce Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Fortunately, I don't get insomnia much, but when I do, I always hope it's around that time when I think it's the Decades Channel in the middle of the night airs episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and I always love that.
She did, almost 20 years later, in the early 1960s, she's back under the Hitchcock auspices. And she had done a bunch of TV by then, and she was somebody who, one of her films that's pretty notable, too, is the year after Phantom Lady. She did The Strange Affair of Uncle Harry, which is indeed a strange affair, if by strange affair we mean verboten incest. And it was, again, it's just this envelope pushing that she would do. And there was the time where not much has ever been written about her. James Agee wrote a few things about her, and he was detailing how somebody comes to interview her, and the brass ones on this woman, she says, do you wonder how I got this job? Do you want to see my legs, or do you want to talk about, like, my ability? It's like, okay, I'm just here to do, like, my interview for the deadline. She strikes me as somebody who brokered no fools in her time, and she had a very versatile career that was mostly not existent after the early 70s, and she lived until her late 80s, in like the summer of, I think it was 94 when she died. Mm-hmm.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Last but not least today, yesterday we had Mike Love of the Beach Boys on the show, and we want to talk about one of their albums from late 1967 that did not do well at the time, but now is looked back on as maybe one of their best and certainly most interesting albums, their foray into the world of soul and R&B, Wild Honey.
It's interesting to me that the Beach Boys, I don't feel like their legacy is assessed as it ought to be. There's so much focus on Pet Sounds, the ethereal Pet Sounds, and the mystique of Smile. And then before that, you have the rock and roll, the surf rock and roll. Then you have studio creationism. But this is the Beach Boys as a rock band.
Mm.
And there's a difference between rock and roll and rock, certainly, and being a studio enterprise. And it's such a short album. It's less than 25 minutes long. But my goodness, did they go for broke stylistically on this? There is a lot of the sound is built off the organ and then singing over the organ, which is a completely different way to sing. It's that Stevie Wonder style of untethered singing. You're out there. You're not as anchored to the beat when you're singing over an organ. And that's why I think they have Carl Wilson, really hasn't been spotlighted as the lead vocal up until this point. This is December 1967, taking so many of the vocal leads right from the title track, Wild Honey, and it's this lo-fi, guzzy rhythm and blues, and they would mine this sound for a few albums. They would do it with friends, and it would last on into the 2020 sessions. But it's this fascinating goldmine of Beach Boys material that is very pioneering, too. Think about the whole lo-fi movement. You think about people like Beck. I bet Beck listened to this album a lot in the early 90s when he was putting out stuff like Loser and all of that. And it's just, there's really no sound quite like it. And it's an infectious album. You mentioned that you were listening to it the other day, but you think about something like Darlin' or Here Comes the Night and How She Boogalooed It. I hear that, and it's like, your musical memory is enslaved to that sound for the rest of the day.
Yeah, and a wonderful cover of Stevie Wonder's I Was Made to Love Her, and the title song, apparently Mike Love wrote, imagining as he wrote it, that it was Stevie Wonder singing the lead vocal.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think they were on the health kit. It was like the Beach Boys go to Whole Foods and spot the honey on the shelf, and they were incorporating that into the sound. You have Brian Wilson on this kick where he's like, you know what, I want to focus on like piano and organ. And you get these contributions from him that are so dreamily endemic to him. I'd Love Just Once to See You. And when he has that moment where it's almost like some 1950s Chet Baker, California, West Coast jazz, see you in the nude, right? It's like, whoa, the Beach Boys can kind of be a little cheeky too. You don't expect that to come from them because you're getting that from the Stones and you're getting that from the Beatles by this point, but you're not getting that naughty-ish schoolboy yet from the Beach Boys, but it's flecked with this aspect of the seraphic. You still have that angelic quality, and it becomes this very non-judgmental, tender, sweet, vulnerable moment, and it's a highly, highly, highly melodic album. I mean, Brian Wilson could be like McCartney or Schubert with his melodic gift, and it's on full display here, but it comes caked in that rhythm and blues, and like it's like Rubber Soul by the Beatles. It doesn't sound like Rubber Soul, but Rubber Soul is folk meets rhythm and blues. And this has those same kind of interesting pairings, too, as if it was like some cuisine fusion restaurant.
Well, and you mentioned the vocals heavily leaning on Carl Wilson, and I think you hear it on this album. You hear it on a song a couple of years later, like their cover of Barry Mann, Cynthia Wilde's I Can Hear Music. To me, Carl Wilson was the most soulful of all the Beach Boys vocalists.
He is. He's like what Mickey Dolenz was to the Monkees.
Yes.
Okay, we have a soulful one. Let's do this. And when you listen to the songs that he sings on this record, like Darlin' and Wild Honey, they're songs that sound like a total gas to sing, right?
Mm.
Like, you do your shower version of them. They're like, certain songs are just more fun to sing than other songs. Like, the Beatles' Yes It is a great song to kind of, like, practice your own singing on. He's so free vocally that it's not true, but it feels like in singing those songs, you're so clipped apart from the meter that you can't screw it up. You just need to be really ebullient. And he does that. And he sings so well. And Brian Wilson made this decision to unleash this musical muscle that they had underplayed for quite a while up until then.
Every Tuesday, Colin Fleming joins us. Other radio people who are listening, why are you not? We don't want you to take Colin from us. Why are you not Colin, to come on your show? Because who else could talk in one session about Herman Melville, Joan Harrison, the Beach Boys, could turn around and talk hockey, baseball, you name it. Colin's on it every Tuesday on our show. We're lucky to have him, but we'd like other people to take advantage of it.
No, that's very kind of you. I appreciate that.
Have yourself a wonderful week. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, my friend.
Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown.